Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things for Hemingway. We're talking about old habits, Die Hard, right? Anna Karenina is broken up into parts. So for the last few months, I've been starting the episode by saying part 5, chapter 3, or whatever. The American, we're talking about The American, which doesn't have parts. It's just one book. The American, chapter 3. What is your first impression of Mrs. Tristram? Is Newman's approach to finding a wife reasonable? And what was your favourite moment from this chapter? Oh my God, I just got... Oh dear. I just got dead animal smell, like bad. Oh my God, dead animal smell, bad. It must be under my house. Or in the... Whoa. Oh my God, that's awful. How did that take like a minute to reach me? Oh, I hope that doesn't stick around for too long. Okay, now we play, is it in the roof, in the walls, or under the house? Or, fourth option, and by far the grossest, is it in the room? I suppose that would be the best option if it's in the room, because then you just remove the dead thing. Anyway, how are you going? Ah, dear... Why now, when I'm stuck in my house for the next few weeks, do I now get dead animal smell? That's not fair, world. Hopefully it just goes away and that's that. Favourite moment of this chapter. Acoustic Eels says, I like Mr. Tristram's series of attempts at interjecting into the conversation between his wife and Christopher Newman. I find it a pretty relatable situation. You introduce two of your friends to each other, and right away they get into a really deep conversation and completely leave you in the dust. You can try to make it about you again, but it's too late. They're totally next level already. Mrs. Tristram reminds me a little bit of Anna Pavlovna from the beginning of War and Peace. I can see her hosting a soiree in her apartment with a group of her friends, trying to get this person talking with that person about the latest intellectual topic, matchmaking this guy with that girl. One conversation group will be on her balcony with one or two more inside. Mr. Tristram will be at the club playing poker the whole time. Mrs. Tristram is being a little more candid with CN about his relationship status in this chapter, but that's probably because it's just the three of them. People have said show don't tell when it comes to writing, but evidently not in James's time. We met Mrs. Tristram and immediately got not only a physical description, but also a thorough description of her character and attitudes. I can't tell if I'm grateful for the context up front or if I'd rather have more of her attributes gradually come to light. We did get a little bit of descriptiveness in the first couple of chapters, didn't we? But I don't know. I think it's well balanced. Here's the thing. When you write CN, I know it's Christopher Newman. And I've already got a pretty good picture of him in my head, or like I'm building one. And same with Mr. Tristram, and same with Mrs. Tristram. They are already, to me, more thorough and vivid characters than the characters of Anna Karenina, the book we just finished. In fact, after 900 pages of Anna Karenina, I was still going, when I would read one of the main characters' names, Levin, who was in the whole book for 900 characters, pages, I would still be like, which one's Levin again? And there was no character in that book who I had as clear a picture of as I already have of these three. So I don't begrudge him from doing a bit of telling, not showing. And it's more, for me, the whole show don't tell thing is like, it's like, think of it as mini spoilers. Like, you don't tell the reader what is their sort of diagnosis or their personality type. You let them discover that themselves. But to give a bit of physical description or even a little bit of description of who they are or what they're about. I don't know. I think it's a good thing sometimes. Well balanced, it's a good thing. Swims to the Marfish, he said, "Oh, I can totally see the comparison between Mrs. Tristram and Anna Pavlovna. My husband constantly watches me instantly enter into deep conversation, so I laughed it out loud at your scenario." Excuse me. "I too noticed the narrative device, but I really liked it. Anna mentioned the second person narrative in chapter 2. This chapter narrative reminded me of a 2007 novel by Joshua Ferris called Then We Came to the End. It's been 13 years since I read it, but I still think about it. Anywho, Then We Came to the End is the first novel by Joshua Ferris. It was released by Little Brown and Company on March 1st, 2007, a satire of the American workplace. It is similar in tone to Don DeLillo's Americana, even borrowing DeLillo's first line for its title." It takes place in a Chicago advertising agency that is experiencing a downturn at the end of the 1990s internet boom. Ferris employs a first-person plural narrative. If the first-person plural point of view, narrator tells the story using we. In the first-person plural point of view, the narrator tells the story using we. That is, no individual speaker identified. The narrator is a member of a group that acts as a unit. Yeah, right. Very cool. I don't think I've ever read that first-person plural point of view. A little bit different from... Well, I suppose... Yeah, but that we isn't including the reader, is it? It's including him, the narrator, and their company that they're with. But it's not... The we isn't... It seems like the we isn't implying that the reader themselves is part of that collective. But where in this one, it's like the reader... the narrator is including himself and the reader as a collective, saying, "We now join our hero as he blah, blah, blah." Anyway, it was just an interesting little way of phrasing, and I think it worked really well. Swims to the Mum Fishy also said, "The Tristram statement, 'No Irish need apply,' caught my attention. It may seem that Tristram is being ignorant and racist, but I believe he was being ironic and referencing signs they all would have seen back in America. My grandfather remembered signs in windows as a young boy in Denver, Colorado, with 'No Irish Need Apply' signs in windows. This would have been in the early 20th century. The Ku Klux Klan was very anti-Catholic. The large majority of Irish immigrants were Catholic as a result of the Irish famine." From Wikipedia, "With rapid growth of the second Ku Klux Klan in 1921-25, anti-Catholic rhetoric intensified. The Catholic Church of the Little Flower was first built in 1925 in Royal Oak, Michigan, a largely Protestant town. 2 weeks after it opened, the Klan burned a cross in front of the church. There was still an American uproar in the 60s when JFK was running for president. There were many people who truly believed the Roman Pope would be calling the shots if JFK was elected." Here is an interesting article about the signs. Article refutes some historians that state the signs never existed. Okay. Irish need not apply. No Irish need apply. Really interesting. Why, I suppose, yeah. So it was a Catholic thing? Or was it something else? Was it something else? I know there was a lot of racism against just Irish in general back in those times. So, I don't know. Interesting, though. Kind of funny now, in retrospect. Let's continue reading, shall we? That's the conversation for today. Just a short one. Oh, God. I'm so yawny. Why am I so yawny? How's everyone going out there? Is anyone, everyone coping well with all this madness that we're currently coping with? You know, I'm really glad to have this community at a time like this. I worked today. we had a wedding at the winery that I work at, a really tiny little wedding, about 25 people. And it was just, it was a really beautiful wedding, but it was very somber. It was the quietest wedding I've ever seen. And very, really beautiful though. It was like the everyone being scared of dying really makes them appreciate the moment. So everyone was very present and somber. It had a real atmosphere to it. Very nice. But now, like, the rest of the weekend's been cancelled at the winery. Next weekend has been. All the schools that I work at, if you know me, you know I do work in schools. That's all been postponed. And my third job, Uber driving, not that keen to do that at the moment. And so, just, you know, well, the same as probably everyone else, I'll just be doing the whole isolating thing, self-isolating, not because I'm sick, but just, you know, just sit this one out for a while, I suppose. So I reckon from now, for the next couple of weeks, I'll mostly just be home. I might pop out to get supplies now and then, and that's it. So, what an interesting time, hey? So, I'm very glad to have this community at a time like this. Something we can connect over. Something that, you know, I sort of still feel like I'm talking to myself sometimes when I do this. But, you know, it beats the actual talking to myself that I've been doing over the last few days, just walking around my house, bored out of my mind. And, you know, after a few days of isolation, you do just start talking to the microwave or, you know, whatever inanimate object. All right, that's enough babbling. Sorry. If you're new to this podcast and you're thinking, geez, does this guy just babble? I don't always babble. Sometimes I babble, but mostly I don't. Anyway, let's keep reading. Chapter 4. And I'll just bear with me for 1 second. How long is chapter 4? Oh, gosh. Hang on. Wait, what was it, chapter 4? Yeah. Oh, God, it's long. Okay, we could be here for a while. Here we go. Early one morning, before Christopher Newman was dressed, a little old man was ushered into his apartment, followed by a youth in a blouse, bearing a picture in a brilliant frame. Newman, among the distractions of Paris, had forgotten M. Nioche and, Mr. Nioche and his accomplished daughter, but this was an effective reminder. "I'm afraid you had given me up, sir," said the old man, after many apologies and salutations. "We have made you wait so many days. You accused us, perhaps, of inconstancy, of bad faith. But behold me at last, and behold also the pretty Madonna. Place it on a chair, my friend, in a good light, so that Monsieur may admire it." And Monsieur Nioche, addressing his companion, helped him to dispose the work of art. It had been endued with a layer of varnish an inch thick, and its frame, an elaborate pattern, was at least a foot wide. It glittered and twinkled in the morning light and looked, to Newman's eye, wonderfully splendid and precious. It seemed to him a very happy purchase, and he felt rich in the possession of it. He stood looking at it complacently while he proceeded with his toilet, and Monsieur Nioche, who had dismissed his own attendant, hovered near, smiling and rubbing his hands. "It has wonderful finesse," he murmured caressingly, "and here and there are marvellous touches. You probably perceive them, sir. It attracted great attention in the boulevard as we came along, and then a gradation of tones. That's what it is to know how to paint. I don't say it because I am her father, sir, but as one man of taste addressing another, I cannot help observing that you have there an exquisite work. It is hard to produce such things, and to have to part with them. If our means only allowed us the luxury of keeping it, I really may say, sir," and Monsieur Nioche gave a little feebly insinuating laugh, "I really may say that I envy you. You see," he added in a moment, We have taken the liberty of offering you a frame. It increases by a trifle the value of your work, and it will save you the annoyance, so great for a person of your delicacy, of going about to bargain at the shops. The language spoken by Monsieur Nioche was a singular compound which I shrink from the attempt to reproduce in its integrity. He had apparently once possessed a certain knowledge of English, and his accent was oddly tinged with a cockneyism of the British metropolis. But his learning had grown rusty with disuse, and his vocabulary was defective and capricious. He had repaired it with large patches of French, with words anglicized by a process of his own, and with native idioms literally translated. The result, in the form in which he, in all humility, presented it, will be scarcely comprehensible to the reader, so that I have ventured to trim and sift it. Newman only half understood it, but it amused him, and the old man's decent forlornness appealed to his democratic instincts. The assumption of a fatality in misery always irritated his strong and good nature. It was almost the only thing that did so, and he felt the impulse to wipe it out, as it were, with the sponge of his own prosperity. The papa of Mademoiselle Noémie, however, had apparently on this occasion been vigorously indoctrinated, and he showed a certain tremulous eagerness to cultivate unexpected opportunities. How much do I owe you, then, with the frame? Asked Newman. It will make, in all, 3,000 francs, said the old man, smiling agreeably, but folding his hands in instinctive suppliance. Can you give me a receipt? I have brought one, said Monsieur Nioche. I took the liberty of drawing it up in case Monsieur should happen to desire to discharge his debt. And he drew a paper from his pocketbook and presented it to his patron. The document was written in a minute, fantastic hand and couched in the choicest language. Newman laid down the money, and Monsieur Nioche dropped the napoleons one by one, solemnly and lovingly, into an old leathern purse. "And how is your young lady?" asked Newman. "She made a great impression on me." "An impression? Monsieur is very good. Monsieur admires her appearance. She is very pretty, certainly." "Alas, yes, she is very pretty." "And what is the harm in her being pretty?" Monsieur Nioche fixed his eyes upon a spot on the carpet and shook his head, then looking up at Newman with a gaze that seemed to brighten and expand. "Monsieur knows what Paris is. She is dangerous to beauty, when beauty hasn't the sou." "Ah, but that is not the case with your daughter. She is rich now." "Very true. We are rich for 6 months. But if my daughter were a plain girl, I should sleep better all the same." "You are afraid of young men?" "The young and old. She ought to get a husband." "Ah, monsieur, one doesn't get a husband for nothing. Her husband must take her as she is. I can't give her a sou. But the young men don't see with that eye." "Oh," said Newman. "Her talent is in itself a dowry." "Ah, sir, it needs first to be converted into specie." And Monsieur Nioche slapped his purse tenderly before he stowed it away. "The operation doesn't take place every day." "Well, your young men are very shabby," said Newman. "That's all I can say. They ought to pay for your daughter and not ask for money themselves." "Those are very noble ideas, Monsieur, but what will you have? They are not the ideas of this country. We want to know what we are about when we marry." "How big a portion does your daughter want?" Monsieur Nioche stared, as if he wondered what was coming next, but he promptly recovered himself at a venture and replied that he knew a very nice young man employed by an insurance company who would content himself with 15,000 francs. "Let your daughter paint 6 pictures for me, and she shall have her dowry." 6 pictures, her dowry? Monsieur is not speaking inconsiderately. "If she will make me 6 or 8 copies of the Louvre as pretty as that Madonna, I will pay her the same price," said Newman. Poor Monsieur Nioche was speechless a moment, with amazement and gratitude, and then he seized Newman's hand, pressed it between his own 10 fingers, and gazed at him with watery eyes. "As pretty as that? They shall be 1,000 times prettier. They shall be magnificent, sublime. Ah, if I only knew how to paint myself, sir, so that I might lend a hand. What can I do to thank you, voyons?" And he pressed his forehead while he tried to think of something. "Oh, you have thanked me enough," said Newman. Ah, there it is, sir, cried Monsieur Nioche. To express my gratitude, I will charge you nothing for the lessons in French conversation. The lessons? I had quite forgotten them. Listening to your English, added Newman, laughing, it's almost a lesson in French. I don't profess to teach English, certainly, said Monsieur Nioche, but for my own admirable tongue I am still at your service. Since you are here, then, said Newman, we will begin. This is a very good hour. I am going to have my coffee. Come every morning at 9:30 and have yours with me. Monsieur offers me coffee also, cried Monsieur Nioche. Truly, my beaux jours are coming back. Come, said Newman, let us begin. The coffee is almighty hot. How do you say that in French? Every day, then, for the following 3 weeks, the minutely respectable figure of Monsieur Nioche made its appearance, with a series of little inquiring and apologetic obeisances among the aromatic fumes of Newman's morning beverage. I don't know how much French our friend learned, but as he himself said, if the attempt did him no good, it could at any rate do him no harm, and it amused him, it gratified the irregularly sociable side of his nature, which had always expressed itself in a relish for ungrammatical conversation, and which often, even in his busy and preoccupied days, had made him sit on rail fences in young western towns in the twilight in gossip hardly less than fraternal with humorous loafers and obscure fortune seekers. He had notions wherever he went about talking with the natives. He had been assured, and his judgment approved the advice, that in travelling abroad it was an excellent thing to look into the life of the country. Monsieur Nioche was very much a native, and though his life might not be particularly worth looking into, he was a palpable and smoothly rounded unit in that picturesque Parisian civilization which offered our hero so much easy entertainment and propounded so many curious problems to his inquiring and practical mind. Newman was fond of statistics. He liked to know how things were done. It gratified him to learn what taxes were paid, what profits were gathered, what commercial habits prevailed, how the battle of life was fought. Monsieur Nioche, as a reduced capitalist, was familiar with these considerations, and he formulated his information, which he was proud to be able to impart, in the neatest possible terms and with a pinch of snuff between finger and thumb. As a Frenchman, quite apart from Newman's Napoleons, Monsieur Nioche loved conversation, and even in his decay, his urbanity had not grown rusty. As a Frenchman, too, he could give a clear account of things, and still, as a Frenchman, when his knowledge was at fault, he could supply its lapses with the most convenient and ingenious hypotheses. The little shrunken financier was intensely delighted to have questions asked him, and he scraped together information by frugal processes and took notes in his little greasy pocketbook of incidents which might interest his munificent friend. He read old almanacs at the bookstalls on the quays, and he began to frequent another café where more newspapers were taken, and his postprandial demates cost him a penny extra, and where he used to con the tattered sheets for curious anecdotes, freaks of nature, and strange coincidences. He would relate with solemnity the next morning that a child of 5 of age had lately died at Bordeaux, whose brain had been found to weigh 60 ounces, the brain of a Napoleon or a Washington, or that Madame P. Charcutier in the Rue de Clichy had found in the wadding of an old petticoat the sum of 360 francs, which she had lost 5 years before. He pronounced his words with great distinctness and sonority, and Newman assured him that his way of dealing with the French tongue was very superior to the bewildering chatter that he heard in other mouths. Upon this, Monsieur Nioche's accent became more finely trenchant than ever. He offered to read extracts from Lamartine, and he protested that although he did endeavour, according to his feeble lights, to cultivate refinement of diction, Monsieur, if he wanted the real thing, should go to the Theatre Francaise. Newman took an interest in French thriftiness and conceived a lively admiration for Parisian economies. His own economic genius was so entirely for operations on a larger scale, and to move at his ease he needed so imperatively the sense of great risks and prizes, that he found an ungrudging entertainment in the spectacle of fortunes made by the aggregation of copper coins and in the minute subdivision of labour and profit. He questioned M. Nioche about his own manner of life and felt a friendly mixture of compassion and respect over the recital of his delicate frugalities. The worthy man told him how at one period he and his daughter had supported existence comfortably upon the sum of 15 sous per diem, recently having succeeded in hauling ashore the last floating fragments of the wreck of his fortune. His budget had been a trifle more ample, but they still had to count their sous very narrowly, and M. Nioche intimated with a sigh that Mademoiselle Naomi did not bring to this task the zealous cooperation which might have been desired. "But what will you have?" he asked philosophically. "One is young, one is pretty, one needs new dresses and fresh gloves. One can't wear shabby gowns among the splendours of the Louvre." "But your daughter earns enough to pay for her own clothes," said Newman. Monsieur Nios looked at him with weak, uncertain eyes. He would have liked to be able to say that his daughter's talents were appreciated and that her crooked little daubs commanded a market, but it seemed a scandal to abuse the credulity of this free-handed stranger who, without a suspicion or a question, had admitted him to equal social rights. He compromised and declared that while it was obvious that Mademoiselle Naomi's reproductions of the old masters had only to be seen to be coveted, the prices, which, in consideration of their altogether peculiar degree of finish, she felt obliged to ask for them, had kept purchases at a respectful distance. "Poor little one," said Monsieur Nioche with a sigh. "It is almost a pity that her work is so perfect. It would be in her interest to paint less well. But if that Mademoiselle Naomi has this devotion to her art," Newman once observed, "why should you have those fears for her that you spoke of the other day?" Monsieur Nioche meditated. There was an inconsistency in his position. It made him chronically uncomfortable. Though he had no desire to destroy the goose with the golden eggs, Newman's benevolent confidence, he felt a tremulous impulse to speak out all his trouble. "Ah, she is an artist, my dear sir, most assuredly," he declared. "But to tell you the truth, she is also a French coquette, I am sorry to say," he added in a moment, shaking his head with a world of harmless bitterness, "that she comes honestly by it. Her mother was one before her." "You were not happy with your wife?" Newman asked. Monsieur Nioche gave half a dozen little backward jerks of his head. "She was my purgatory, monsieur." "She deceived you?" "Under my nose, year after year. I was too stupid and the temptation was too great, but I found her out at last. I've only been once in my life a man to be afraid of. I know it very well. It was in that hour. Nevertheless, I don't like to think of it. I loved her. I can't tell you how much. She was a bad woman." "She is not living?" "She has gone to her account." "Her influence on your daughter, then," said Newman encouragingly, "is not to be feared." "She cared no more for her daughter than for the sole of her shoe. But Naomi has no need for influence. She is sufficient to herself. She is stronger than I." "She doesn't obey you, hey?" "She can't obey, monsieur, since I don't command. What would be the use? It would only irritate her and drive her to some coup de tête. She is very clever, like her mother. She would waste no time about it. As a child, when I was happy, or supposed I was, she studied drawing and painting with first-class professors, and they assured me she had a talent. I was delighted to believe it. And when I went into society, I used to carry her pictures with me in a portfolio and hand them round to the company. I remember once a lady thought I was offering them for sale, and I took it very ill. We don't know what we may come to. Then came my dark days, and my explosion with Madame Nioche. Naomi had no more 20-franc lessons, but in the course of time, when she grew older, it became highly expedient that she should do something that would help to keep us alive. She bethought herself of her palette and brushes. Some of our friends in the quartier pronounced the idea fantastic. They recommended her to try bonnet making to get a situation in a shop, or, if she was more ambitious, to advertise for a place of dame de compagnie. She did advertise, and an old lady wrote her a letter and bade her come to see her. The old lady liked her and offered her her living and 600 francs a year. But Naomi discovered that she passed her life in her armchair and had only two visitors, her confessor and her nephew. The confessor very strict and the nephew a man of 50 with a broken nose and a government clerkship of 2,000 francs. She threw her old lady over, bought a paint box, a canvas and a new dress and went and set up her easel in the Louvre. There, in one place and another, she has passed the last 2 years. I can't say it has made us millionaires, but Naomi tells me that Rome was not built in a day, that she is making great progress, that I must leave her to her own devices. The fact is, without prejudice to her genius, that she has no idea of burying herself alive. She likes to see the world and to be seen. She says herself that she can't work in the dark. With her appearance, it is very natural. Only I can't help worrying and trembling and wondering what may happen to her there all alone, day after day, amid all that coming and going of strangers. I can't be always at her side. I go with her in the morning and I come to fetch her away, but she won't have me near her in the interval. She says I make her nervous, as if it didn't make me nervous to wander about all day, without her. If anything would happen to her, cried Monsieur Nios, clenching his two fists and jerking back his head again portentously. Oh, I guess nothing will happen, said Newman. I believe I should shoot her, said the old man solemnly. Oh, we'll marry her, said Newman, since that's how you manage it, and I'll go and see her tomorrow at the Louvre and pick out the pictures she is to copy for me. Monsieur Nioche had brought Newman a message from his daughter in acceptance of his magnificent commission, the young lady declaring herself his most devoted servant, promising her most zealous endeavour, and regretting that the proprieties forbade her coming to thank him in person. The morning after the conversation just narrated, Newman reverted to his intention of meeting Mademoiselle Naomi in the Louvre. Monsieur Nioche appeared preoccupied and left his budget of anecdotes unopened. He took a great deal of snuff and sent certain oblique, appealing glances towards his stalwart pupil. At last, when he was taking his leave, he stood a moment after he had polished his hat with the calico pocket handkerchief, with his small, pale eyes fixed strangely on Newman. "What's the matter?" our hero demanded. "Excuse the solicitude of a father's heart," said Monsieur Nioche. "You inspire me with boundless confidence. But I can't help giving you a warning. After all, you are a man. You are young and at liberty. Let me beseech you, then, to respect the innocence of Mademoiselle Nioche." Newman had wondered what was coming, and at this he broke into a laugh. He was on the point of declaring that his own innocence struck him as the more exposed, but he contented himself with promising to treat the young girl with nothing less than veneration. He found her waiting for him, seated upon the great divan in the Salon Carré. She was not in her working-day costume, but wore a bonnet and gloves and carried her parasol in honour of the occasion. These articles had been selected with unerring taste, and a fresher, prettier image of youthful alertness and blooming discretion was not to be conceived. She made Newman a most respectful curtsy and expressed her gratitude for his liberality in a wonderfully graceful little speech. It annoyed him to have a charming young girl standing there thanking him, and made him feel uncomfortable to think that this perfect young lady with her excellent manners and her finished intonation was literally in his pay. He assured her in such French, as he could muster, that the thing was not worth mentioning, and that he considered her services a great favour. "Whenever you please, then," said Mademoiselle Naomi, "we will pass the review." They walked slowly around the room, then passed into the others and strolled about for half an hour. Mademoiselle Naomi evidently relished her situation and had no desire to bring her public interview with her striking-looking patron to a close. Newman perceived that prosperity agreed with her, the little thin-lipped peremptory air of which with which she had addressed her father on the occasion of their former meeting, had given place to the most lingering and caressing tones. "What sort of pictures do you desire?" she asked. "Sacred or profane?" "Oh, a few of each," said Newman, "but I want something bright and gay." "Something gay? There is nothing very gay in this solemn old Louvre. But we will see what we can find. You speak French today like a charm. My father has done wonders." "Oh, I am a bad subject," said Newman. "I am too old to learn a language." "Too old? Quiffwilly," cried Mademoiselle Naomi, with a clear, shrill laugh. "You are a very young man. And how do you like my father?" "He is a very nice old gentleman. He never laughs at my blunders." "He is very comme il faut, my papa," said Mademoiselle Naomi, "and as honest as the day. Oh, an exceptional probity. You could trust him with millions." "Do you always obey him?" asked Newman. "Obey him? Do you do what he bids you?" The girl stopped and looked at him. She had a spot of colour in either cheek and in her expressive French eye, which projected too much for beauty. For perfect beauty, there was a slight gleam of audacity. "Why do you ask me that?" she demanded. "Because I want to know." "You think me a bad girl?" And she gave a strange smile. Newman looked at her a moment. He saw that she was pretty, but he was not in the least dazzled. He remembered poor Monsieur Nyoche's solicitude for her innocence, and he laughed as his eyes met hers. Her face was the oddest mixture of youth and maturity, and beneath her candid brow, her searching little smile seemed to contain a world of ambiguous intentions. She was pretty enough, certainly, to make her father nervous, but as regards her innocence, Newman felt ready on the spot to affirm that she had never parted with it. She had simply never had any. She had been looking at the world since she was 10 years old, and he would have been a wise man who could tell her any secrets. In her long mornings at the Louvre, she had not only studied Madonnas and St. John's, she had kept an eye upon all the variously embodied human nature around her, and she had formed her conclusions. In a certain sense, it seemed to Newman Monsieur Nyoche might be at rest. His daughter might do something very audacious, but she would never do anything foolish. Newman, with his long-drawn, leisurely smile and his even, unhurried utterance, was always mentally taking his time, and he asked himself now what she was looking at him in that way for. He had an idea that she would like him to confess that he did think her a bad girl. "Oh, no," he said at last, "it would be very bad manners in me to judge you that way. I don't know you." "But my father has complained to you," said Mademoiselle Naomi. "He says you are a coquette." "He shouldn't go about saying such things to a gentleman. But you don't believe it?" "No," said Newman gravely, "I don't believe it." She looked at him again, gave a shrug and a smile, and then pointed to a small Italian picture, A Marriage of St. Catherine. "How should you like that?" she asked. "It doesn't please me," said Newman. "The young lady in the yellow dress is not pretty." "Ah, you are a great connoisseur," murmured Mademoiselle Naomi. "In pictures? I know very little about them." "In pretty women, then?" "In that I am hardly better." "What do you say to that, then?" the young girl asked, indicating a superb Italian portrait of a lady. "I will do it for you on a smaller scale." "On a smaller scale? Why not as large as the original?" Mademoiselle Naomi glanced at the glowing splendour of the Venetian masterpiece and gave a little toss of her head. "I don't like that woman. She looks stupid." "I do like her," said Newman. "Decidedly, I must have her as large as life and just as stupid as she is there." The young girl fixed her eyes on him again with her mocking smile. "It certainly ought to be easy for me to make her look stupid," she said. "What do you mean?" asked Newman, puzzled. She gave another little shrug. "Seriously, then, you want that portrait? The golden hair, the purple satin, the pearl necklace, the two magnificent arms. Everything just as it is. Would nothing else do instead?" "Oh, I want some other things, but I want that too." Mademoiselle Naomi turned away a moment, walked to the other side of the hall and stood there looking vaguely about her. At last she came back. It must be charming to be able to order pictures at such a rate. Venetian portraits, as large as life. You go at it in prints, and you are going to travel about Europe that way.
Yes, I intend to travel, said Newman.
Ordering, buying, spending money?
Of course I shall spend money.
You are very happy to have it, and you are perfectly free.
How do you mean free?
You have nothing to bother you, no family, no wife, no fiancé.
Yes, I am totally free.
You are very happy, said Mademoiselle Naomi gravely.
Je le veux bien, said Newman, proving that he had learned more French than he admitted.
And how long shall you stay in Paris? The young girl went on.
Only a few days more.
Why do you go away?
It is getting hot, and I must go to Switzerland.
To Switzerland? That's a fine country. I would give my new parasol to see it. Lakes and mountains, romantic valleys and icy peaks, oh, I congratulate you. Meanwhile, I shall sit here through all the hot summer, daubing at your pictures.
Oh, take your time about it, said Newman. Do them at your convenience.
They walked farther and looked at a dozen other things. Newman pointed out what pleased him, and Mademoiselle Naomi generally criticized it and proposed something else. Then suddenly she diverged and began to talk about some personal matter.
What made you speak to me the other day in the Salon Carré? She abruptly asked.
I admired your picture.
But you hesitated a long time.
Oh, I do nothing rashly, said Newman.
Yes, I saw you watching me, but I never supposed you were going to speak to me. I never dreamed I should be walking about here with you today. It's very curious.
It's very natural, observed Newman.
Oh, I beg your pardon, not to me. Coquette as you think me, I have never walked about in public with a gentleman before. What was my father thinking of when he consented to our interview?
He was repenting of his unjust accusations, replied Newman.
Mademoiselle Naomi remained silent. At last she dropped into a seat.
Well then, for those five it is fixed, she said. Five copies as brilliant and beautiful as I can make them. We have one more to choose. Shouldn't you like one of those great Rubenses, the Marriage of Marie de Médicis? Just look at it and see how handsome it is.
Oh yes, I should like that, said Newman. Finish off with that.
Finish off with that, good, she said. She laughed. She sat a moment, looking at him, and then she suddenly rose and stood before him, with her hands hanging and clasped in front of her.
I don't understand you, she said with a smile. I don't understand how a man can be so ignorant.
Oh, I am ignorant, certainly, said Newman, putting his hands into his pockets.
It's ridiculous. I don't know how to paint.
You don't know how?
I paint like a cat. I can't draw a straight line. I never sold a picture until you bought that thing the other day.
And as she offered this surprising information, she continued to smile.
Newman burst into a laugh.
Why do you tell me this? He asked.
Because it irritates me to see a clever man blunder so. My pictures are grotesque.
And the one I possess?
That one is rather worse than usual.
Well, said Newman, I like it all the same.
She looked at him askance. That is a very pretty thing to say, she answered. But it is my duty to warn you before you go further. This order of yours is impossible, you know. What do you take me for? It is work for 10 men. You pick out the most 6 difficult pictures in the Louvre, and you expect me to go to work as if I were sitting down to hem a dozen pocket handkerchiefs. I wanted to see how far you would go.
Newman looked at the young girl in some perplexity. In spite of the ridiculous blunder of which he stood convicted, he was very far from being a simpleton, and he had a lively suspicion that Mademoiselle Naomi's sudden frankness was not essentially more honest than her leaving him in error would have been.
She was playing a game. She was not simply taking pity on his ascetic verdancy.
What was it she expected to win? The stakes were high and the risk was great. The prize, therefore, must have been commensurate. But even granting that the prize might be great, Newman could not resist a movement of admiration for his companion's intrepidity. She was throwing away with one hand whatever she might intend to do with the other, a very handsome sum of money.
Are you joking, he said, or are you serious?
Oh, serious, cried Mademoiselle Naomi, but with her extraordinary smile.
I know very little about pictures or how they are painted. if you can't do all that, of course you can't. But what you can, then do what you can then. It will be very bad, said Mademoiselle Noby. Oh, said Newman, laughing. If you are determined it shall be bad, of course it will. But why do you go on painting badly? I can do nothing else. I have no real talent. You are deceiving your father, then. The young girl hesitated a moment. He knows very well. No, Newman declared, I am sure he believes in you. He is afraid of me. I go on painting badly, as you say, because I want to learn. I like it, at any rate, and I like being here. It is a place to come to. Every day it is better than sitting in a dark, little dark, damp room on a court or selling buttons and whalebones over a counter. Of course it is much more amusing, said Newman, but for a girl, for a poor girl, isn't it rather an expensive amusement? I am very wrong. There is no doubt about that, said Mademoiselle Noemi. But rather than earn my living as some girls do, toiling with a needle in little black holes out of the world, I would throw myself into the scene. Well, there is no need of that, Newman answered. Your father told you my offer. Your offer? He wants you to marry, and I told him I would give you a chance to earn your dot. He told me all about it, and you see the account I make of it. Why should you take such an interest in my marriage? My interest was in your father. I hold to my offer. Do what you can, and I will buy you that paint. And I will buy what you paint. She stood for some time meditating with her eyes on the ground, at last looking up. What sort of a husband can you get for 12,000 francs? She asked. Your father tells me he knows some very good young men. Grocers and butchers and little maitre d' cafes. I will not marry at all if I can't marry well. I would advise you not to be too fastidious, said Newman. That's all the advice I can give you. I'm very vexed at what I have said, cried the young girl. It has done me no good, but I couldn't help it. What good did you expect it to do? I couldn't help it, simply. Newman looked at her a moment. Well, your pictures may be bad, he said, but you are too clever for me, nevertheless. I don't understand you. Goodbye. And he put out his hand. She made no response and offered him no farewell. She turned away and seated herself sidewise on a bench, leaning her head on the back of her hand, which clasped the rail in front of the pictures. Newman stood a moment and then turned on his heel and retreated. He had understood her better than he had confessed. This singular scene was a practical commentary upon her father's statement that she was a frank coquette. Oof. All right, there we go. Another chapter down, chapter 4 complete. Sorry about the terrible reading. Suddenly I'm all sinusy. Not good. And tired. Sorry about that. I hope you got through it. I hope it made sense. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening. Go and have your say about this chapter, and I'll see you tomorrow.